Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and in this podcast, I talk to my guest about the five things from their life that they would choose to preserve in a time capsule. They pick four things that they cherish and one thing that they loathe, something they'd like to bury in the ground and never have to think about again. My guest in this episode is one of the great stand-up comedians of the past 30 years, and certainly the most distinctive, Omid Jalili. Since first appearing at the Edinburgh Festival in 1995 with the show Short Fat Kebab Owner's Son, Omid has toured the world a number of times, always with sell-out shows. He's had his own HBO special in the USA, his own series on the BBC, and has hosted Have I Got News For You. On stage, he's played Fagin in Oliver and Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, and played major roles in the films Gladiator, The Mummy, Mean Machine, the Bond film The World Is Not Enough, Notting Hill, Pirates of the Caribbean At World's End, The Infidel, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, and Sex in the City 2. And that's just the films. Or some of them, anyway. His list of TV credits is three times as long. For example, he was a regular in the US sitcom Whoopi, starring Whoopi Goldberg, and has been in everything from Black Books to My Family and Other Animals, Dickensian, and His Dark Materials. Omid won a Best Supporting Actor International Film Award for his performance in Casanova, starring alongside Heath Ledger and Jeremy Irons. And perhaps most impressive of all, he was the voice of Trumper in the Shaun the Sheep movie. I could go on, but I'd rather let Omid do it. So here is Omid Jalili and the five things he chose to put in a time capsule. And a few other things, obviously. Before we start, this episode was recorded before the tragic death of the great Sean Locke. Now, Omid does mention him in this episode, but in such a lovely way that we felt we should keep it in. Thanks.
Let's get going.
Yeah, let's do it. It's so lovely to have you on My Time Capsule.
It's great to be here.
Well, I know what a busy man you are, so I'm really grateful for you giving up an hour of your time to talk bollocks with me.
Always a pleasure to talk bollocks with anyone, to be honest.
Particularly after the last year we've had, where amazing. I've seen you do some extraordinary things on social media, as it were. I have to say, you are probably the best lip-syncer I've ever come across.
Are you talking about the Shoop video? Yes.
Yeah, it was fabulous.
I had been offered this thing, lip sync battles, and I said, I can't do that. So I said no to it. And then people said, why? Why don't you do it? And I think my kid said, why don't we go out and do some lip syncing? So that was just to see if I could do it. And then by the time I thought I could do it, then the offer had gone. So yes, thank you. I'll take the compliment.
Good. And also, you've been doing concerts in another language.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah, it is. It's something I was asked to do last year after the first pandemic. I was asked to do, just to be a guest on a show. Yeah, we've got someone called Sina Valiullah, who is kind of like the Conan O'Brien of Iran. But to be like a Conan O'Brien, he has to work outside of Iran because they don't do those kind of comedy shows in Iran. So I think I went on and said a couple of, my Persian is not so good, but I think people found it charming. You know, in the same way, people who have what you call small dick energy, I have a small dick energy that when you've been, guys with small dick energy, they say, whenever I'm with a woman, they describe my performance in bed as charming. You know, it's small dick energy. And I think I had this small Persian language energy where it's not very good, but I spoke with confidence and I kind of sounded like Osvaldo Ardiles speaking English. But apparently it was very charming and it was apparently very funny. And Iranian culture is really very, very conservative, but also at the same time, because the Iranian regime is so brutal, the people have become extremely politically correct. They don't tolerate jokes about the other. If we do a joke about Scousers being a bit kind of like nicking things, that is an absolute no-no. I know it's not politically correct to do it now, but in Iran, if you do it, it's appalling.
Yeah.
So I did a joke about a gay guy about to be executed, and the executioner says, any last words? He goes, can I tell a joke? I said, go ahead. He goes, two gays walk into a bar and the executioner says, you're just making this worse for yourself. And I think that joke kind of, they took it out of the interview. Then they were talking about it online. So it became like a legend that I'd done this. I have no sensitivity. So I say appallingly offensive things, but people, because I was born and raised here, they kind of forgive me. So I've got a bit of cult status there. So I'm now doing stuff in the Persian language as well.
Yeah. Your parents were Persian. Did they come over to England?
Well, they came. My parents got married in 58 and they moved to Britain after spending some time in Germany. But my mother was a seamstress and she wanted to, she'd heard about Carnaby Street. She'd heard about London being like a swinging place in the late 50s, swinging 60s. Yeah. And so they moved here. My dad was a liaison officer at the Iranian embassy in Kensington. And we just kind of stayed. And they were very funny people. I mean, my dad was the kind of person who at a formal event would, you know, Iranians are very much, you've got to get up and dance. And he'd say, no, I don't want to dance. Please dance. Because I can't dance. You've got to come and they drag you out. And then he'd start dancing. And he would have like loosened his trousers so his trousers would fall down, you know, in a very formal event.
Yeah.
And my mother was very much into joke construction and joke structure. So she'd tell a joke when I tell her, I don't understand it. She goes, well, this is it. I said, but doesn't make sense. She goes, no, but it's a surprising. When you'll understand one day, joke writing and joke construction is you set something up and there's something surprising at the end. It emits laughter. Mm. So it's interesting. I came from parents who were very much into comedy, but I suppose weren't really allowed to do it. Because, you know, in Iranian culture, there's only three careers ahead of you. One is either medicine or law or social disgrace. Not many people went into social disgrace, but I grabbed that wheel with both hands.
Yeah. Now, I'm only going to talk to you about this now because I just happened to look at it this morning when I did that thing that you do where you Google people. Mm. And right at the start of it, it said your parents were Baha'is. And I only mention it now because some time ago, I read most of the Baha'i writings.
No, are you being curious?
Yeah, no, seriously,
wow,
in English.
Incredible.
It is incredible because it's a very unknown religion, isn't it? And it's a very small group of people who follow it. And it's a very forgiving religion. That's the thing I remember reading. You know, I'm not at all religious. And then I read it and thought, this is completely harmless. It was extraordinarily sort of friendly and open.
It's amazing. The prophet founder of the Baha'i faith, Baha'u'llah, who was prisoner in the prison city of Acre in Palestine, which is now Israel, which is why a lot of Baha'is are... We're accused of being Zionists because our, you know, Baha'i holy places were in Palestine and now it's Israel. And he wrote to all the kings and rulers.
Yes, amazing.
Proclaiming who he was. The only monarch who wrote back was Queen Victoria.
Yeah.
She was the only person who wrote back who said, if this is from God, it will endure. If this is not from God, no harm will come of it. So she was like saying, there's nothing wrong with this at all. You know, and it's interesting. Then Queen Marie of Romania became a Baha'i. And interestingly, having come across one or two of the royal family members, they're very proud. They're very proud of the fact that there was a Baha'i, a queen in their family, because the Baha'i faith is, if you don't know much about it, it's a faith that it grew out of Islam in the same way Christianity grew out of Judaism. Mm. So Christianity is a completely different faith to Judaism, but there is a connection. So the Baha'i faith is a totally independent world faith, but there is that connection with, I suppose, monotheistic religion. So it believes in the one God. It believes that religion is all from the same book. And the Baha'is believe that their faith is the latest, but not the last chapter.
No, it's a very interesting viewpoint, isn't it? That actually, you know, Muhammad and Jesus are prophets from the one God.
Yes.
And that this is...
The name of the prophet is Baha'u'llah.
Baha'u'llah, that's right, yes.
Which means glory of God. And actually, Christ does say he comes back in the glory of the Father. So there is that connection, but in the Baha'i faith, it makes it very, very clear that if you reject one of these prophets of God, you're rejecting them all. Mm. So in a sense, I believe in Moses, I believe in Buddha, I believe in Krishna, I believe absolutely in Jesus. But by accepting Baha'u'llah, it does not, I suppose it doesn't say that those, forget them, they're all part of the same. But it's like reading a book. You can't say, well, forget about chapter three. Mm. Chapter seven is where it's happening. Well, you know, you may be on chapter seven, there's a chapter eight coming. So it's an interesting paradigm in how to look at life, which I think is very, it's very helpful. We're always looking for paradigms to make sense of who we are, why we're here, where are we going when we die. Mm. So yes, if you're talking about what I'd put in the time capsule, definitely the Baha'i faith would be one of the first things, only because it's given me so much joy of understanding who we are, why we're here, all those big things. And I think if I wasn't a Baha'i, I'd definitely be an atheist. I don't like religion. I think religion has caused so much damage. Mm. Well, but then even that is explained, that religion is something that needs to be renewed. Religion is something that it has a sell-by date. You know, in the same way Muslims didn't eat pork because the way they treated pigs in those days, you ate pig meat, you got ill. All that stuff about having four wives or something, that was because men used to go to war and there were way more women than men. So that was a law of Islam that, again, has been abrogated by the Baha'i faith. The religion is something that's progressive. That's why we call it progressive revelation. So it's not something that is like, you believe this and that's it. Mm. There's no dogma in it. So it is something that progresses. And, you know, people like you, you're obviously a very reasonable person. You read about the Baha'i faith and you remember that it wasn't something that was harmful. So
no, when I read the stuff and I thought, well, I quite like this bloke. And I like the fact that it was only then, what, 1890 or something, he's in prison. He's sending letters all over the world to people saying, look, this is the message I've been given. I am the latest prophet. Which, you know, anybody who stood up and claimed that, the world would say, well, you're mad. It happened to every other prophet.
Yes, I know. Yes. And that's the thing. But it's interesting you say it's a small group of people, but it's actually the second most widespread faith on the planet right now, and it's the fastest growing. And I think that's the amazing, next to Christianity, I think it's the most widespread faith. And it's actually a very cool faith. When I meet other Baha'is who are in showbiz, like there's Rainn Wilson, who played Dwight Schrute in The Office. You know, yeah. These are two people who really love the Baha'i faith, the Sean Locke and Bill Bailey. Mm-hmm. They're the two. And I remember one coming back from Harrogate, and he kept asking me, Sean, well, what do you do? And what's it? Because I want to be a Baha'i. This is fantastic. And what is your worldview? How are you going to change the world? God, this is, he goes, everyone should be Baha'i. This is amazing. And then he said, I've got a big question. He said, do you guys drink? I said, no, we don't drink alcohol. He goes, I said, well, you can still. He goes, no. He goes, no, I could never give up the drink. I said, well, you just because you can't give up something. A lot of people don't give up things just because. And he says, no, if you join something, like something as wonderful as the Baha'i faith, it's all or nothing for me. If I can't do it all, I won't do any of it.
Yeah.
And he said, I have too much respect for this. Because all you want, the last thing you want was a drunk one person like me. Now they go, I'll get drunk, punch someone. Because you're best off without me.
Oh, well, that's nice, though, isn't it? Because you do hear people sort of go, no, I'm a bit Buddhist. You go, a bit Buddhist. Oh, okay, fine, you know. I try not to kill ants. Oh, well done.
I mean, I'm actually amazed that we're having this podcast. Every podcast of yours I've heard, it's always hysterical. The first.
Oh, I like to bring the changes. And actually, the idea of putting things into a time capsule from your life is really to look at parts of your life that you wouldn't normally talk about.
Yes.
You sort of go, well, you know, let's talk about something that you treasure from your childhood. Let's talk about something before you were an actor, before you were famous.
Oh, completely. And one of the first things I put in the time capsule was my time in the former Czechoslovakia around 1989. Mm-hmm. The Berlin Wall was coming down, and amazingly, all those pictures of David Hasselhoff at the wall, New Year's Eve. I was there, amazingly, when it all kicked off. I went straight to Berlin. People don't realize that that was a huge moment in history. We were not allowed to go across the Iron Curtain. I mean, I remember going with my school to East Berlin, but it was very difficult. We went on a school trip and we went to East Berlin just for an afternoon. That was it. We had these special visas and then we went in, we looked around and I never forgot it. And I remember thinking, that is so crazy. Obviously following the Olympics, Czechoslovakia had these, they always seemed to have so many steroids in them. They seemed bigger, stronger than us. And when the opportunity came to visit those places, and certainly at the Berlin Wall, getting a pickaxe and knocking bits of it down and selling pieces for 5 Deutschmarks, which is like, you know, 3-4 quid. I was doing that. And then they said, hey, there's a Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. That's next. Right, let's go. And I went there. And because there had been lots of Baha'is actually in Czechoslovakia, we went and reconnected with those people who hadn't seen Westerners for 40 years, wow. Western Baha'is. And it was interesting to meet those people. And I lived there. I lived there for 5 years. I lived first in Bratislava and then a town called Trnava and then Brno, where there was a center for experimental theater. So I my whole theater life, I'd studied theater at university, but doing experimental theater where, I mean, my goodness, Michael, seriously, I never forget being in a play where opening scene, black stage, pin spot on a goldfish being lowered from the top of the stage on a string, pin spot comes down. Comes this side, lights come up. I've got a Magnum 44. I go click. A small explosive device goes poof, and I shout. The goldfish is obliterated. And I go at the top of my voice, Lenin! Blackout. No clue. No clue what's going on. But that was it. They said, you are made for us. This is the place you should be. Experimental theater. We are going to reach the world. My professional life started there. I was doing children's theater. And then they wanted to see plays that had been banned. So we did Eugene Ionesco's The Chairs, which they hadn't seen. I know they'd heard of Stephen Berkoff. They said, can you do some Berkoff? We said, okay, I put on Decadence for them. So it was an amazing, and we brought these amazing directors over. I mean, Sir Peter Hall's son, Edward Hall, he came out and directed a play. So I was keeping my contacts in Britain with good people, but at the same time, we were doing very exciting work in the former Czechoslovakia. And then I started my stand-up career there because I'd learned the language. I'd learned Slovak.
Yeah.
But there was a real, I suppose, boom for English speaking. So I said, look, I'm developing a stand-up show. Do you want to see it? And so they were paying me 1,000 crowns, which is 20 quid. I had to go all the way to Prešov, which is Eastern Slovakia. Because we have 250 people there. And I started, I said, good evening. My name is Omid. Omid means hope. It's a shame that Jalili means less. No laughter. I said, okay.
No.
Nothing was getting laughed. So then I said, do you speak English? And they, I didn't get anything back. Then I said, hovorite po anglicky, which means do you speak English? And this voice in the dark said, velmi malo, which means very little. So I said, pokračujeme po slovensky, which means let's carry on in Slovak. So it emptied the room. People were leaving and it was like 5 or 6 or 7 people were left. And 3 people watching who were helping me with the Slovak language because it was pidgin. And there were 3 or 4, I'll never forget, 3 or 4 kind of KGB type people watching in a kind of postmodern, post-Marxist way of let's see the Westerners struggle with our language kind of thing. And I sat there trying to finish my show. And then literally I said, that's it, it's finished. And it was only about 7 people and there was just this slow hand clap started. And I thought, I've done it, I've arrived. I'm a stand-up in Czechoslovakia. It was a wonderful experience. So that would be, I think, my formative years, 5 years there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that nerve, that carries on right through your career. That sort of slightly absurdist element that you've always had in stand-up. I mean, I remember a routine you used to do playing the drums. You used to play timpani. You just sing ridiculous songs and then play the drums for a bit, then tell a joke. No real reason for it. Almost inexplicable, but incredibly funny as a result.
I think that whatever it was, I think I screamed, take me for what I am. It was some kind of plea. There was an existential plea for you to accept my existence on a ridiculous existential level. I just felt people didn't know me. But if I played bongos, I can't even remember what the routine was. But I think there's always been that kind of experimental, because I've come from experimental theatre and I was always doing terrible plays, you know, upstairs at the Oxford Arms, in Camden. There was the Etc. Theatre Club. There was all these Ephimbra Arms. I did so many years on the London Fringe doing ridiculous fringe theatre. I think it kind of affected my stand-up. So the stand-up became... Here's the other thing I wanted to put into the time capsule. It was that same sense of anarchy coming from an experimental theatre background that then got me some kind of mainstream success, because around 2002, 2003, I'd been to Montreal just before the Edinburgh Festival, and I had all these bizarre television companies trying to do a deal. It was like very few times British comedians get picked up for a talent holding deal. I know Boothby Graffo had one. Lee Evans had one. Very few of us had them, but they were chasing me. It was just after 9/11. And then what happened was I signed a deal to do my own show on NBC.
Oh, wow.
And I remember being very, very uncomfortable, because I thought this is not good. This is not good to go to America before I've made it in Britain. But they kept saying, we want you because we've been looking for someone like you, someone who can cross over. Your humor's a bit wacky, but I think we'll like it. We want to do a show with you. And then the tanks rolled into Iraq around March 2003. They said, look, we can't have you do your own sitcom right now, but we can use you as an actor in someone else's sitcom. So Whoopi Goldberg invited me to do her sitcom. And she said the same thing. She said, you're crazy. You're nuts. And she said, are you a Muslim? I said, no, I'm a Baha'i. She went, oh, I like Baha'is. Baha'is are cool. So that it really helped me, because I think she thought it'd be a problem if I was a Muslim, because there'd be so many sensitivities, especially this is just after 9/11 as well. So we did a pilot. It was meant to be like Fawlty Towers. They bought the Fawlty Towers. So she was Basil, and I was a Polly, Sybil, and Manuel conglomerate running the hotel with her. But it was an amazing experience. And I'll tell you why, because it was a multi-camera sitcom. And I've never learned so much in my life. Now, I'm speaking to you now as an actor, not a comedian. You know, as actors, we're quite humble over here. And if there's an extra wants to talk to you, we'll talk to them. We'll probably chuck them. Might even get involved in their lives sometimes. An extra would say, would you come and do a charity? Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
In America, you're not even allowed to talk to them. They don't even call them extras. They call them atmosphere. Did you know this?
No. Wow.
That's the word atmosphere. They'll say atmosphere. Could you?
Oh, my God. And in this country, they're offended by the word extra.
Yeah.
Supporting cast, they would be called.
You're a supporting cast. Before that, it was background artiste, I think they even said. Whereas over there, I learned they won't even make eye contact. I remember talking to some of them. I said, hey, how do you feel about being atmosphere? And they would look away. I said, come on. I said, hey, come on. Look, here's $20. Next time they call you atmosphere, I'll give $20 to anyone who says, hey, it's ambiance to you. And they wouldn't even look at me.
No.
They wouldn't even make eye contact. So I thought it was very interesting. But the main reason I want to put this in the time capsule is because of Whoopi Goldberg. She was someone who was not just a co-actor or actress or whatever you want to call her. She was like a mentor, because she said, now listen, you people, meaning brown people, you're about 30 years behind black people. Because she did something. She shouted at the writers. I think she could see my frustration that every week we'd play around with the script. And every time the first script would always be back to doing Ayatollah jokes. It was all very, very two-dimensional. And she, by episode 8, she gave this tirade. And then she goes, Ayatollah jokes? Is that the best you got? This guy's an award-winning comedian from Britain. We're honored to have him. And he's showing you how to rap for him. He's doing high-level stuff. And you can't even keep up. If I see one more Ayatollah joke, you're out. And I said to her, thank you. And she goes, I got your back, baby. I got your back. And she'd say, you got to understand, you're like the Richard Pryor of brown people. I said, don't compare me. She goes, no. Pryor for us was someone who showed us the way. He was doing stuff for white folks, and then he realized that was not authentic. So he started doing stuff about him and who he was, and that was revolutionary. So she was really encouraging me to write my own stuff, keep doing stand-up. And she kept saying, never stop doing stand-up because you have to have an authentic voice. And I said, yeah, but I was born and raised in Britain. So she goes, whatever it is, baby, you got to be you. The black community will always support the brown community because you need help. Because nobody helped us, but we will support you. And she did everything she could to support me. And then she reminded me, this was a huge thing. She goes, she kept saying you and Billy. And I kept saying, she kept saying, I bring you and Billy. I don't know who she was talking about. About 6 months in, I said, I'm really sorry. You keep talking about this. Who's Billy? And she went, Billy Connolly. And I said, what's he got to do with me? She goes, God damn it. You're the only two people I introduced to America. I said, what? Because apparently she introduced him. She took him over.
She did, famously. She famously put on shows, invited hordes of celebrities. Come and see this man. He's a genius.
I think, do you know what? From what she said, she had an HBO special, but she gave most of it to him. I think it was her special. She did 15 minutes and the rest of it was him. So she kept saying, you two people make me laugh like I was crying. So I said, that's the Billy you're talking about. I said, you cannot compare me to Billy Connolly and Richard Pryor. You just can't do that. I said, you have no idea. So I've never talked about that, but just for my ego, also for my ego. And you love this story. For her 50th birthday, you know, she knows everyone. Whoopi Goldberg's one of those people. She's an Oscar winner. At her birthday, Sting was there, Robert De Niro, and all these huge people had come to her birthday party. And she said to me something like, no, I know you're going to say some shit, so you better be on your best behavior. I don't want you ruining things. And I think she already saw me with Sting. It was a 50s theme thing, but I came wearing tails. I think I came wearing tails and a bow tie. And Sting said, what have you come as? I said, I've come as Dracula. And he said, why? It's the 50s theme. And I kept going, and she just pulled me away from me. She goes, I told you, you're not going to say shit to me. She goes, you're an asshole, and I'm going to keep you away. So she then put me on her, and this is just such a brilliant story. She put me in this table where there were two people on each side of me, and there was a table in front, so I couldn't get out. She goes, stay there and don't move, because she just thought I'm going to embarrass her. And then Robert De Niro came in, and apparently his girlfriend had been watching this show and really liked my character. And then I just saw Robert De Niro, who, if you don't know, De Niro is, for our generation, he's like one of the best actors. Yeah. I've always wanted to meet De Niro or Pacino, and he just appeared. I didn't know they're good friends. He just appeared, and he just said, hey, he's here, he's here. And he was pointing at me, he's here. And then his girlfriend said, oh, my God, Omid. And she was talking to me, and I said, what's going on? He goes, yeah, sorry. She thought you were someone else. We watched the show. You're very funny. And she thought you were that guy there. But I said, that's not him. It's him here. And we started talking. They had just been announced that he'd had bowel cancer. Robert De Niro. He's since recovered, but he just had bowel cancer. Mm. It had just been in the news the day before. And I really wanted to give him a hug. And I couldn't. And I said, Mr. De Niro. And his girlfriend was talking to me. And they were talking to me. Can you imagine? There's 5-6 people there, but they're only honing in on me. So I was a bit embarrassed. And I said, if I could get up, I'm stuck. Whoopi's put me in. She's kind of shackled me in. If I get up, I'd give you a hug. And he goes, hey, don't worry about it. Christmas time, we'll kiss on the lips. We'll do the whole British soccer player in the 70s. He goes, we'll kiss on the lips. And I started laughing. And then everyone else started laughing. And he had this comedic thing where he thought, that's not, I have to go further. And he says, hey, you know, kiss on the lips, maybe you'll take me in the ass, might do me some good. And I thought, oh my God, he's just done a joke about me helping him with his bowel cancer in a way I never expected.
That's amazing.
And I just said, Mr. De Niro, I'm at your service. And it was wonderful because that was then the first of 3 meetings I had with him, because then 6 years later, the film I did with David Baddiel.
The Infidel.
The Infidel, yeah. The film, it was bought by De Niro, and I'll never forget. It was a moment when he said he loved the film. He goes, the film is great. He said, you know why we did Tribeca Films? Because it was after 9/11, and we wanted to reclaim the cultural heritage of New York, but the olive branch was always out to the Middle East. And then I'd heard about this film, The Infidel, and I just couldn't believe how funny it was. I never thought a film about Jews and Muslims could be so funny. And he just said, that's great. And I thought I'd had enough time with him. I said, well, thank you very much. And I started moving away and he grabbed me. He goes, where are you going? Where are you going? And he kept looking at me. He kept doing this, kind of going, fucking eyes. I can't stop laughing. You got your eyes. You just make me laugh. And I just, because there's something about you. I don't know why. And he kept saying, what are you doing? Where are you going? Where are you going? So I was trying to get away because I felt like a typical English, I've had my time with him. Mm. And he kept grabbing me. He goes, where are you going? What are you doing next? Will you do a film with me? And, you know, because I want to know what you've got. He goes, oh, you got something. I don't know what you got. I got to learn it. And I said, don't be stupid. You can't learn anything from me. Because I look at you and start laughing. You think I can't learn something? So he was, it was just such an amazing experience to have.
Yeah. And what a sign of a great man. Actually, I think all the great men I've met in my life are not at all concerned about themselves.
No.
They're interested in other people, always.
And one thing I learned about, he's very funny as well. And they say this whole thing about the actors, the older they get, they veer towards comedy. I said to him, you're doing more comedies now. He goes, I love comedy. He goes, actually started off. He goes, look at the first scene of Mean Streets. Look at the first scene. Tell me that's not funny. So I went back and I saw Mean Streets. And the very first time you see him, when they introduce his character, he's just put a bomb in a trash can. And it's just him walking up towards the camera and he's looking back. Then he does this, he looks back, then it explodes and he runs off. It's hysterical. It's genuinely very, very funny. And he said to me, look at the first scene. Tell me that's not funny. So he's trying to say that he said Al was the same. And I didn't know what he was talking about. Then I did my research. Al Pacino also started off in comedy. He was a stand-up comedian. He did sketch comedy. And then story with him was he was always trying to be funny. And Sidney Lumet says the problem with Al Pacino is he still thinks he's a comedian. He doesn't realize how good he is as a dramatic actor. But the way you work with Al, let him do his comedy shtick for the first six takes. Then on the seventh take, the one before you print, you just whisper, hey, Al, do one where you throw it away. And he goes, we would build a film on take seven. Take seven or eight of everything. So Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico. There's a whole host of films he did with Sidney Lumet. It's all seventh or eighth take.
Really?
So he's someone who never took himself that seriously either. No. So that's why they have this kind of weird gold dust charisma that's very hard to find. And I think that is actually not taking yourself too seriously.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, then I'm going to put that into the time capsule.
Okay, good.
So that's three things you've got in there. You've got the Berlin Wall, knocking bits off and selling it, and then going off to Czechoslovakia and doing crazy theatre. You've got working with Whoopi Goldberg. If only we could all put that into a time capsule. How fantastic. Yeah. And then De Niro. I mean, just amazing, amazing. So that's three things. What else have you got? Right, it's time for an ad break now, but do stay with us. We'll be right back. Thanks.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back to part two of my time capsule with Omid Jalili. Let's find out what else he's going to put in his time capsule. I wonder if he'll mention anybody famous.
As far as career highlights, I think everyone says great films you've done. And yeah, it was really great to be in wonderful films, life-changing films, actually. When I remember telling a friend of mine, a comedian called Andre Vincent, he kept saying, "You're in Gladiator in the film." I said, "Andre, I'm only in it for 3 or 4 minutes." He goes, "It's 3 or 4 minutes more than I'm in it."
It's true.
And that's such a perfect comedian's answer. And I think that when you're on these big movies, it does impact you in the sense you see the scale of it. I'll never forget the very first day was my POV, my point of view. There's a camera. So I'm behind the camera and I say, "Proxima, my old friend." And then there's a camera pushing on Oliver Reed, who's there, and he looks. It's just that's my first day of shooting. It's the first thing I did, a camera pushing, saying my lines, as they say, speak to Oliver Reed. And it was meant to be in this AD 180 cafe, and there's smoke and there's action. It's so packed. And I thought, what an amazing scene. No wonder this guy, Ridley Scott, is such a rich, and I was looking at it. He said, "Come and watch." So I was watching the camera. And then he went, "Cut." And I never forget, he got his cigar out. He goes, "We've got a second of dead time. I need a dog or a little person." And then out of nowhere, they bought this very small person and a dog. He goes, "Yeah, could you two wipe it?" And then he goes, "Okay, let's reposition. Action." We did the same thing. Proximo, my old friend. We go in there, and at the back of the scene, you just see a dog and a small person. And he went, "Okay, got it." We moved on.
Wow.
That was the level in which, because I said to him, "Ridley, why are you, like, you got a marketplace, like there's 5,000 extras here and there's like 100 oranges, but the camera, you're only picking up 2 or 3 oranges." And he just said, "The camera never lies." I said, "I know it doesn't lie." He goes, he said, "There's something about packing a shot. If you pack it, it affects the scene. If you lie, it knows. And even in the edit, you'll see there's a bit of dead time there, or there's a blank there where there should have been oranges. But the camera really will pick up the richness if you pack the shot full." So that was an amazing experience to see.
And the last work that Oliver Reed did.
Yes. Did you ever work with Oliver Reed?
No, never did, sadly. I did meet him once.
What was he like?
He was a bit drunk.
Well, that's the thing. Apparently he'd signed a contract not to drink on Gladiator because nobody wanted him. But Ridley Scott said, "He's my man and I have to have him." So he had to sign these waivers that he'll be teetotal 4 months before. He'll be teetotal all throughout. Of course, you spend time, 95% of this business sitting around like us. If this could be a film set where you and I are just chatting away. And then they'll say, "Okay, Michael and Omid," you think, "Oh, for fuck's sake, we're chatting here."
In the middle of an anecdote.
In the middle of an anecdote. Don't ever, ever interrupt me in the middle of an anecdote. And he was very gracious. And I said to him, I was a bit nervous about meeting. I stayed in the hotel. He goes, "Oh, no, that's all nonsense." He goes, "I do like a drink and I've stopped and it's all nonsense because I'm taking my career seriously." He's about 67 at the time. And he was very generous with his time. He talked to me. We chatted the whole 3 days. We were together. And he'd sit and tell me his life story. And it was very sad the way he died, actually. I've said this before, but everyone says it's the way he wanted to go, but actually he didn't. He was challenged to a drinking competition and he got alcohol poisoning very quickly and died. And it was such a shame because the press narrative was that that's the way he wanted to go. But actually, it was devastating for the film. He never finished his scenes. And by the way, when I read Gladiator as a script, the ending is profoundly moving because it's him. He comes down and picks up Russell Crowe's character and gives this massive speech about the end of Rome and that the spirit of this centurion will go on, but Rome is over. You're morally corrupt, and I'm going to give this guy a hero's burial. And he lifts his body up above his head and he walks him out to silence.
Oh.
It's meant to be totally silent. So he's, I don't know how many people are meant to be there, 20,000, 30,000 people go silent. It was very moving, but they couldn't do that.
No.
So I think Connie Nielsen had a line, "Give him a hero's burial and he's a hero of Rome" or something. So people were devastated that he never finished what was in the script.
For something that really, to many people, is fundamentally a perfect film, I think, Gladiator. You describing that ending makes us realise it's not.
It's not the perfect film at all.
That would have been extraordinary.
It would have been extraordinary. And there were other things in it, which he had some other stuff to do, which he never got. He finished about 75% of the movie. And he was very much involved in the big denouement, which I, having read the script, And anyone who did, we know it was much poorer for it.
Yes, but still a great film.
Yes.
Okay, let's put working with Oliver Reed in Gladiator into the time capsule. Okay, Omid, what's next?
There's always moments that you remember, and I think it was Prince Charles's 60th birthday party. There was an amazing collection of comedians. I think John Cleese was the MC. Robin Williams had come down, and I think it was myself, Michael McIntyre, Al Murray, Joe Brand. And before we did the show, we had to practice our sets.
Yeah.
And there's a guy called Maff Brown who has a small comedy club in Kingston called Outside the Box. He invited us all to come down in a 60-seat little comedy club. And so we all were there, and there's just a tiny partition between us. And we all went down there. So he said, please, we welcome Omid Jalili. And then that was enough. Here's Joe Brand.
Oh, my word.
And he goes, please, would you welcome, you know, Al Murray? And people couldn't believe it. And I'll never forget. He goes, well, we're going to leave the best for last. And I don't know how to introduce him, but please, would you welcome Robin Williams? And no one believed it. And he came on, and there was 60 people went nuts. Something funny happened. It was great. He just came on. And he went, good evening, how are you? And someone just went, flubber, like that. And he collapsed. He actually, he goes, what do you mean flubber? Are you kidding? What? What did you say? You were flubber, weren't you? He goes, yeah, so what? So what, I was flubber? And he had a meltdown. He had a meltdown. And afterwards, he kind of rattled through his set. And afterwards, I said to him, what happened last night? He goes, I'm Robin Williams. I've done so much. And the best thing you're going to bring up is flubber? Flubber? Are you kidding me? That piece of shit? It threw me. And this is a guy who's the best improviser in the world. He goes, it threw me. He absolutely collapsed. It was so funny. But the best moment was that after we were doing our sets. By the way, when we say inside the time capsule, you're talking to a comedian and an actor. So I have an ego the size of Alaska. So this for me was the moment. And again, it's a line that never made it. We had to practice our sets. And I remember John Cleese going in the thing. He goes, good luck, Omid. Just rattle through your set. And he walked off. And I could hear Robin Williams and John Cleese saying, watch this guy, watch his set. And then Robin Williams said, he's insane. Watch him. So the two of them were watching me. And I did one joke, which they cut, which they wouldn't let me do. And I think the joke was, this is a great evening. I haven't had such a good time since I did the Al-Qaeda charity fundraising gig last week. It was terrible. There was no music, no women, no alcohol. It was a bit like spending an evening down Cliff Richard's throat. And they stopped. They said, you can't do that. And I remember John Cleese and Robin Williams pissing themselves saying, why? Why can't he do that? That's a brilliant joke. And seeing the two of them scream at the producer saying, why can't he use that? And I'll never forget that. I said, it's okay. Well, I won't do it. They goes, no, you do that. And they goes, no, there's a voice going, you are not doing that. And then John Cleese said, well, I'm walking. They were like joking. But it was just such a funny moment to see the two of them giggling like school children. And then, so for my ego.
To have Robin Williams describe you as insane.
He goes, this guy's insane.
It's just brilliant.
And the amazing thing was that it was only afterwards, he actually said, he said to me, I apologize because I'd met you in New York. I'd met him in New York very briefly at a comedy club. And he kept saying to me things like, you've lost so much weight and it's great to see you again. And I've been such a fan of yours. And I'm thinking, he doesn't say that. And I said to him, who do you think I was? I honestly thought you were Alexei Sayle. So he thought I was Alexei Sayle. He goes, because I thought you'd lost a lot of weight. I said, actually, I'm the same size. I'm the same size. Like, because I can see that. That's my ego moment. But the biggest ego moment, and this is the, well, there's two more things. We've got to put something into the ground. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Something you want to get rid of.
I want to get rid of. And I really want to, and I wish I could do it. I don't know if I can. I don't think I'll even be allowed. But I wish I could put Twitter into the ground. I'm sadly, excuse me, I've just burped in the middle of that. I'm not addicted to it, but I feel I have to tweet every now and again. And Michael, I don't know if this is an age thing, but I find that every time I tweet something that's really funny, I lose followers. And every time I tweet something nice, I lose like hundreds of followers. And there was once. I never forget this. This is my relationship with Twitter. Very few times I get a tweet that bangs and goes like 1,000 retweets. Very few times. I have the world record for someone who has over 290,000 followers that I achieve one retweet with a tweet. I often have this just one retweet from a bloke who retweets everything I do in Tasmania. He retweets everything. One retweet and one like. And this is so unusual. It's impossible. It is impossible. It's, you know, like Google Whack. I don't know if you saw Google Whack. It was Dave Gorman did a show. Yeah. Put in two words and you get one website. I'm the same. I do one tweet and I achieve one retweet.
You've got to find a word for it.
I've got to find a word for it because it's impossible.
It'll be a twat.
I'm the biggest twatter there is. But I want to give you an example. And this is why I want to put it in the ground. Once I stupidly did I made a DVD, but the whole DVD market had gone. And I thought, what I'll do is I'll do a DVD download. I'll cut the show down to 45 minutes and I'll give it for free. So I sent a tweet saying, hey guys, free DVD download just for my Twitter lot. Here's the passcode. Go to this. It's for you for free download. It's yours. Fill your boots. Okay. At the same time, I saw a guy I knew called Justin Baldoni, who's in a show called Jane the Virgin. He said, hey, same time, I saw his tweet was next to mine. Hey, guys, Jane the Virgin's back on 8 o'clock. And he posted a picture of himself, you know, with just in kind of swimwear. He had a six pack. He just looked like that. And he had like immediately 1,000 retweets. And I had no retweets, no likes, nothing. I left it for about 2 hours. I came back and I saw his tweet had gone to 23,000 retweets. Mine had no retweets. No likes, one comment saying, watch you, I'd rather kill myself, which I then retweeted and it got 800 likes. And I lost 1,500 followers. And I just thought, I don't know if this is an age thing. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's my age or something. Twitter shouldn't just be a young person's game. But
no,
and here's the thing. I had a Twitter analyst look at my stuff. I said, what am I doing wrong? And he just said, I don't know what you're doing wrong, but looking at the analysis that you have had, 2.7 million people have followed you over 10 years.
Wow.
And you're left with 290. So you have had something like 2.5 million people have unfollowed you. And wow. I said, well, what am I doing wrong? What am I doing wrong? He said, I think you engage too much with people who are trying to engage with you. You engage with bots. I see you told someone with no followers that they were a twat. I said, but they were a twat. He goes, yes, but that's a bot. You don't need to communicate with them. You are very easy to rile. You have long conversations with people. I don't think you realize this goes on everyone's timeline. They can see it.
Right.
So I've tried to clean up my act. But he said, but that is 2.5 million people have unfollowed me.
That's amazing, isn't it?
That has to be a record. It has to be.
Yeah. Oh, Omid, oh, lovely. I must follow him. Oh, for God's sake, it's driving me mad. I'm going to unfollow.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I'm also putting it down to mild racism. I'm playing the racism card as well. I put that to someone. She goes, no, you're just a twat. I said, okay, I'll take that as well. Hilarious.
Well, I'm sure having worked with David, you'll know how amusing it is when somebody, I'm sure you've had racist abuse, but almost certainly the wrong racist abuse.
Yeah, I think the thing is, David and I are both from the same camp where if a troll or someone says something, it's a heckle. I'm sure he's talked to you about that. It's a heckle. Yeah. And you try and put a heckle put down. And the thing he is that very few times a piece of humor is then appreciated by the troll. I think I made a mistake recently. I said that the song, the Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall, I had read that South Africa had banned it because it was a song that made teenagers rebel. And I remember it was actually geared to my generation. It was such a, we don't need no education. Hey, teacher, leave them kids alone. And I remember as a child being aware of being abused and seeing bad behavior, but we never had a voice that we could never articulate. But after this song, I remember a teacher shouting at a kid, because come here, I'm going to smack you or something. And I remember the whole class, we all just lifted up our shoulders and he noticed and he looked around. He goes, well, you sit down and you're lucky. We just realized we're not taking this anymore. We didn't say anything, but we just got into fight mode.
Yeah.
We were 13 or 14. But we thought, we're not having this because that song's taught us not to take it anymore. And I remember, and I just said on Twitter, amazing song. It's a song that Margaret Thatcher banned, which is wrong. Margaret Thatcher never banned it. She hated it. She never banned it. So somebody then tweeted me, once again, lefties are having a go at Margaret Thatcher. How dare you? And all this kind of, and I just wrote back, Thatcher was an extremist Muslim and she thought music was haram. And then the bloke, and really, I'm kind of surprised, he just said, that's the best response I've ever had. And he quote tweeted it back. Whereas usually I've stopped doing that because the humor is not appreciated. So I'm not bothered. But that's the first time someone's appreciated a funny joke. Mm. And then I afterwards said to him, by the way, I'm sorry, I didn't mean... it's not Margaret Thatcher, it was actually, so I got it wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And all comedy is a risk. It's a difficult area. You're going to say things that some people will go, oh, hang on a minute. No, you can't say that. He said, well, no. I've said it. I'm sorry. Just ignore me. I'll be in the corner making my mistakes. And I think that's fine in life. In order for comedy to work, people have to be given the chance to make mistakes.
And do you know what? Going back to the Baha'i faith, that's what I was taught as a young Baha'i growing up, that it's okay to make mistakes. I was given an example of these two villages in Africa, one of which was kind of very much a Baha'i village, and they got together, and there was a village next door. They said, what's the difference between the two? And they said there was some sociological survey said in one village, whenever somebody makes a mistake, the whole community supports them, saying it's okay, don't worry, get back up on your feet. Whereas the other one, they are brought in front of the village and they're stoned and they are shamed in front of everyone. And I think that's a very important thing, not just in comedy, in life, is to never be afraid to make mistakes. And I think that's where I've also, as a stand-up comedian, I'm a little bit worried that I'm 55, I'm going to go on tour again. I'm going to do and say some stupid things that will probably make the newspapers again. Mm-hmm. But actually, you should never be fearful. Just do it. And then part of life is problem solving. Then you can deal with the problem if you've really offended people, but I think not to be afraid of mistakes.
You can always apologize, can't you? You can always say, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize that was going to offend. It just came out of my mouth. I'm so sorry. And really, that should be enough.
Yeah.
Also, look at you, Omid. I mean, do you look like the sort of man who wants to upset people, who wants to hurt people? No. you want to make people laugh.
Yes.
And if in doing that, every now and again, somebody says, well, actually, I don't find that funny at all. I find that offensive. You go, well, then I'm sorry. There you are.
Yeah, you have to know your audience. I mean, there are certain like roasty lines you can tell people. Like if someone's got really shiny teeth, then you can say things like, this is an admonishment, you know, never to buy your teeth on the internet. Or, you know, someone, an old person, you know, I've seen younger faces on cash. You say things like that. And if you know the audience, it's okay. But if you say it when it's not the right audience, I have to say I've learned that. I've learned a little bit more about who the audience is. I just haven't worked out the Twitter audience yet.
No.
That's the thing I'm working on.
Okay, well, Twitter's gone in for you.
Twitter's in.
Great.
So Twitter is definitely in. But the thing, Michael, you brought out the ego in me, and I'm going to now talk about...
Don't blame me.
You brought this out of me because...
You're normally so shy, so reserved. Never talk about yourself.
I'm the best! This podcast is I don't like doing podcasts in general because I always feel funny people, when you really get to know them, they're actually very dull. And I really worry that I'm just the dullest person going on about his ego. I honestly, I am a fat, needy man pleading for attention. This is what happens to me. At dinner parties, I'm appalling. I take over. I just tell anecdotes. But this is the thing that is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And people who know me on Twitter, in fact, if this goes out on Twitter, you know, you make your little bits that you put out. If this goes out on that little bit on Twitter, and if I retweet it, I will lose 1,000 followers. And that's me scoring a goal against RoboKeeper, which is the greatest moment in my life. If you haven't seen it, I ask you to Google it. Mm-hmm. I ask you to look at it. It's a robotic keeper that it took Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. They actually couldn't beat it. There's footage of Messi taking 16 penalties and he couldn't, because it moves. It moves as soon as your leg is about to hit the ball, it knows where it's going and it moves to where you're going. So you can't give the RoboKeeper the eyes. It's impossible to score. But I went on the one show and I took one shot, and for some reason it went in. Maybe it was a glitch. I know that they decommissioned RoboKeeper, because if a fat middle-aged man can score with his first kick, there must be something wrong. But I did it, and I did what Lionel Messi couldn't do. And that kind of, I have to say, it healed every wound of my childhood. It healed everything in my life. It's the greatest moment in my life. And if you see it, you can see it in my face. As soon as I score, I go bananas. Now, the problem is, it's on a small bit outside Broadcasting House, and it looks like a children's playground.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So when I came home, I told my family, they said, "We saw you on TV." I said, "I did what Messi couldn't do." They said, "First of all, this is very inappropriate. And second of all, you've just scored a goal in a children's playground. Why is that so great?" I said, "You don't understand my life."
This is the greatest goalkeeper there's ever been.
It is. It's impossible to beat it. It is a robotic keeper that will move to where you're going.
And it knows where you're going to hit the ball. It anticipates it. See, I think what happened is you didn't know where you were going to kick it, so it didn't.
Ah, maybe. But I'll tell you this. I will say, before I kicked it, I said, "Is there any chance?" He said, and the guy says, he goes, "There is literally like a millimeter to 2 millimeters margin of error. But if you go top left, there's a possibility that we've left a little gap, but it's impossible." Mm. I said, "Okay, I'll just go." So I shut my eyes and went top left, and it actually went through. If you play it back, I've played it back. The keeper is there and the ball goes in just where, and there's literally millimeters to spare on each side. Wow. It was the perfect place to hit it. And I go bananas. I go absolutely bananas. It's inappropriate to see a middle-aged man celebrate that much over nothing.
Please, please tell me you didn't take your top off.
I should have. I really should have. That would have sealed the day for me, but no, I didn't.
Absolutely glorious. What a glorious thing.
Promise me that you'll Google it.
As soon as we're finished. I'm tempted to do it now, but I won't. I'll do it when we finish. Okay. I will look at it because I want to see your face. And then I'll pause it and imagine you ripping the top off and doing a Ronaldo.
If you're a football fan, there's nothing greater that could happen to you, actually. But that was it. Once I did that, then the hankering after the creating a memory was gone. That was it.
Well, it's a good enough one.
Thank you.
You can say, "Well, there is something in football that I'm better than Messi at."
Yes, and it's so inappropriate, but I'll take it. My ego.
Ovid, how lovely to talk to you. Fantastic. Thank you so much for telling me those things.
As long as I was funnier than Rob Brydon, that's all I care about.
Most people are. You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my fantastic guest, Omid Jalili. Thanks to him for sparing the time, and thanks to you for taking the time to listen. If you had fun, then please do subscribe to this podcast. Then you can listen to all past episodes and all the lovely ones we have coming up. You can subscribe with Acast or the podcast provider of your choice. And do rate us if you get a chance. Highly, I hope. You can follow me or My Time Capsule on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, and you can hear the theme tune in full on Spotify. It was composed and performed by Pass the Peas Music. Our producer was John Fenton-Stevens, and this has been a cast-off production for Acast. If you'd like to see Omid live, then he'll be touring the country with his show, The Good Times Tour, with dates available so far up until November 2022. Yep, that's one hard-working man. All details are on his website. But actually, talking of hard-working men, I've got an exhausting voiceover to record, following my success at the Advertising Awards last week. Yeah, I was there, but I recorded it, and then I watched it back afterwards. You know, a bit egotistical, I know, but yeah, it didn't take long. Well, it was the Advertising Awards, so I fast-forwarded through the whole thing. Bye.